knowledge is gained from superiors, so therefore that is important. But to do that, there's some basic principles. It means he has to get into the classroom. Therefore then, in the classroom, how he's supposed to behave and all that, then it finally gets towards the teacher. Once the knowledge is protected, then it comes to the teacher. Then it continues again, now that all that's in place, now then what duties he'll perform. Okay, so he must, you know, daily do some kind of worship. There must be that, depending upon their line, and they're doing some kind of respect of their supreme, you know, goal, their supreme, what they're trying to attain. So then some restrictions will naturally be there, because there's always something that's favorable, something that's unfavorable for devotional service, or for whatever is their path. So then that must be performed. Then menial service and begging. So then these are very important. It says, subsistence of a student on begged food is equal in merit to fasting. So what benefit you get by doing fasts is gotten by begging. So they eat, but it gets the similar thing. So you'll find that many times in the Vedic, is that performance of one activity, you get the benefit of this another, even though it may not appear that way. Fasting means you don't eat. Here they're begging and eating, but because they've gotten their food by begging. So for the brahmacharya, that's equal to fasting. You know, because that's an austerity. They must go out and must be humble, like this. And then whatever they go out and get, then that's given to the teacher. So like this, then you know, you get good benefit. Grihastha goes out begging, but then it's still that principle of humility and all that is there. But it's not equal fasting because it's his. You know, he's eating, he gets merit for having lived by begging. But here is they're getting that, plus they're getting, so they're getting for the brahmacharya and they're getting this for the fasting. Then you have etiquette with the teacher. So he'll always study the Veda and do service. So he must study, because that's what he's there for, to gain knowledge, and he must render service. That aspect must be there. Because the service then will inspire him to study more. So the two go together. By studying, then you want to apply it. And then by application, you want to learn more. So this way then they each nourish the other. The more you know, the more you want to do. The more you do, the more you want to know. So the two go together. Okay, then dress, respectfulness, avoidance of disrespect, results of disrespect. Okay, so sitting with the teacher, then he may sit in, you know, they have to know when he can sit equally, when not. You know, like if you're sitting on a mat, it's really hard for someone to sit higher and lower. Or you're sitting in a vehicle, it's very hard to sit higher and lower. So certain situations, benches, mats, rocks, you know, like this, boats, vehicles, then you can't, you know, make any decisions. So he has to understand this. He has to respect the teacher, so there's rules for that, but at the same time, this is the practical application. That's always an important thing, is that the Vedic literature, what it gives, always must be practical. It can't not be practical. You know, this is an important element, is that if you can't apply it, what's the use? Because culture means it's applied, right? Culture is not unapplied. Culture is applied. So that's important, that it has to be applied. So then, others to whom honors due, you know, other services. If service is avoided for the wife of his teacher, if the teacher's wife is young, then he doesn't, if he's older and she's younger, then he doesn't do any service for her, any personal service, like that. But if he's young and she's older, then, you know, he can help and do things like this. It's not a big problem, like this. But this one always has to remember that the situation of the guru in the ashram, you know, as a grihastha, it's slightly different than the child in the house. Because otherwise it'll be seen, well, he's grihastha, we're grihastha, what's the difference? Because in the grihastha ashram, then the home is there because of the woman. So that means you basically create the house environment for the protection and maintenance of the women. Because men don't need that kind of facility. Man can sleep anywhere, do anything. You know, he just doesn't want his stuff to disappear. It should be convenient, that's all. It should be practical. But other than that, doesn't need much more. It's not a matter of prestige or facility or this or that. As long as it works and it's, you know, not going to, you know, be an inconvenience by things disappearing or stuff like that, then it's okay. But so the household environment then is for the women, because they, their social life, their, you know, their comfort, their facilities to deal with family members, guests, relatives, all these different things then is required. So then, when do we start?
You start to tell my child his different position in the house of...
Oh yes, that's right. Means is because means here he's dealing with the wife of the teacher, but it's going to be a different attitude, because there we see in the normal Grihastha, then the consideration is the wife. So how it works in the house, basically she runs, but then the ultimate authority is the husband, you know, to see that standards are maintained. It's just like, does that make sense? It's like the business people do their business, the citizens do what they do, the king sees that it's going right. He doesn't, they do what they like, but it's, you know, it's, it works under their direction. Or the kings manage, but then the Brahmins see that it's going properly. So in the same way as the husband sees that it's going properly, that the standards are there, the right attitude, Krishna consciousness, and, you know, it's progressive. The same time as, you know, day-to-day management of the household affairs is done by the women. So, but in the, when they have a gurukul, that principle is there, but it is more hidden, because now in the house it'll be set up for gurukul. There's areas in the house, of course, that's for, you know, the wife, that she can run as they are, you know, would be, because they are grihasthas, so that element is there. But there is the aspect that's the teacher's house, and then there's the teacher's wife, right? So it's slightly different than there's the child and there's the parents. Because in the house, then the wife will be prominent. You know, and the father's in the background, is the authority. But here, the teacher is the prominent and the wife is in the background. Though in their own quarters, like that, then the relationship between the teacher and his wife, that's their own business. You know, how they run in that. But outside that, does, that area, then it is the teacher's house. And the wife is simply assisting the teacher. So it has a slightly different flavor. Therefore, these are her husband's students. So she's like a mother to them, right? The wife of the Brahmin, or the wife of the teacher, is one of the seven mothers. But at the same time, it's still his child, because he's had that child without her, right? It means the child is a conception of his mind. You know, he, within the mind, is nourishing this child. So the teacher is the father, and the Veda is the mother. Then she is a wife, she is another mother. She's not the mother, she's a mother. So it has a slightly different flavor. Does this make some sense? Mm-hmm. So that's why in the Gurukul system, then you may have parents involved. I mean, you may have women around, but it's not their field. It's the man's field, and they can assist within it. So sometimes the mistake is made that because it's, you know, grihasthas were involved, therefore the women can be involved, but they'll run it like it was their own home, where they're the center, right? Rather than it's the teachers the center and they're assisting. So this is what makes the difference. They are grihasthas, but there is this different flavor. So then one must be careful of all these things. So remaining on guard in the company of females, then that always starts with the father, with the mother, the daughter, and the mother, the daughter, and the sister. One must always be on guard. One always has to be careful, because the senses are very powerful. Okay, one must, yeah, this is a famous verse. One should not sit in a lonely place with one's mother, sister, or daughter. And then there's proper respect, and that, if the student follows all the laws, the rules that are designated for him, then he will be able to take from the teacher all the knowledge that's hidden. Because the teacher gives knowledge according to the student's ability to learn it. If he's not acting as a good student, applying himself, then he may not learn. He may not be given that knowledge. So if he's proper attitude, the obedient student obtains the knowledge lying hidden in his teacher. So the obedient student. Otherwise they don't obtain. You don't tell people who are not obedient knowledge. They give some little bit of direction and all that, but you won't really get down to what is important. Like that. Then some, you know, rules on other more on his dress. He has to balance balance his results so there's religious practice. He knows that everything's balanced. You can maintain your sadhana. Don't do something more that you can't maintain. But don't do less either. Because overbalance either way is not considered good. It has to be what is maintainable, what is progressive. Right? Honoring one's superior. So the teacher, the father, mother, and elder brother must not be disrespected. Right? You know, it's like we see Pallad Mahalars, even though his father was a demon, he still dealt with him according to etiquette. He didn't agree what he said, he would present his opposing opinion, but he would present it in a proper way according to etiquette. Him as the son, him as the father, you know, he'd address his father in, you know, affectionate way, you know, oh greatest of the demons, you know, like this, you know, like this. He was very affectionate. Okay, so then acquiring knowledge in times of distress, just in case you're trying to get some certain knowledge, you can't, then even a teacher is not the person to be the teacher, but they have the knowledge. Then for the time that you need, you can take that knowledge from him. When that learning is done, then that relationship as teacher ends. Does that make some sense? You wouldn't maintain it. Like if the teacher is qualified, then even after your study, that you remain as your teacher and that relationship is there. But in times of distress, then that's someone who's not technically supposed to be a teacher, but you can gain that knowledge from. They're dealt with like a teacher while you're studying. But as soon as the study is finished, then that relationship then goes back to whatever would be the natural relationship. You know? Like Kshatriyas and Vaishyas go to Gurukul also. So then you may find is they have the knowledge, so they could teach you, but it's not their occupation. So they can teach you, but not as an occupation. And you'll deal with them, you respect them as a teacher, everything like that, but as soon as these learn, then it goes back to whatever the natural relationship would be. Like that. They're the Brahman, they're the Kshatriya, so the Brahman is now the teacher of the Kshatriya, though he learned from him. Does that make some sense? Mm-hmm. Like that. You know, naturally he will, how do you say it? You know, there will be some consideration there because of the relationship. But at the same time, it's still, you know, he was just doing what he could to assist. Naistika Brahmachari, then the Naistika then means that he continues this throughout the life. He doesn't get married. Like that. So then he can continue like that. And so then that would mean, it just means that he continues these duties of a brahmachari for the rest of his life. That's a nice speaker. Upakurvana then we see is dealt in the next discourse. So then the Upakurvana, then he will graduate. So then that means if he's going to graduate, then he makes a presentation to the teacher that he's, you know, in consideration of what he's gained in the way of knowledge and according to his ability. And then he moves on. Then we go into the third discourse, which then starts the Grihastha Ashram. So you have the topic 5, the rule of bathing, so that's graduation. The graduate is called Snataka, which means one who is bathed. Like that. Because he is sprinkled with water by the teacher, so like that. So then he's accepted in the community as an adult, a trained adult. Like that. So he's no longer a brahmachari, no longer a kid. Like this. Then only those who are going to get married graduate. So then next is the law of marriage. So you have appropriate and inappropriate arrangements. One always has to see to that. You know, appropriate means that the nature of the boy and girl are match, and they don't have common relatives. Like that. That's the main point. There must be separate bloodlines. Like that.
So this, in Europe, cousins would marry that wouldn't?
It depends which cousin. It's not a widely practiced thing, but I think it's on the mother's side. Then those first cousins can marry. Exactly what the details are, I don't know. But it's practiced only by certain communities. But there is a community, some of the Brahmins in the south follow that, and it seems to be not an uncommon thing. Like we see that Arjuna married Subhadra, who's cousin on the mother's side. You know, so there's something there, because basically what it is that there, that match is the same as the nature of the grandparents. Does that make some sense? Mm-hmm. Because the boy's mother, Let's see, how's it going? Boy's mother then is there, so then the mother's brother, mother's brother, then have the daughter, right? So now, yeah, the mother, yeah, okay, because the girl takes the qualities of the father, followed by the mother. So the son will have the qualities of his mother, right? And the daughter will have the qualities of her father, right? And so that father and mother are brother and sister. So that will reverse again into their parents, which are the grandparents. Does that make some sense?
Yeah.
So you get the same nature as the grandparents in the grandchildren who are first cousins on the mother's side. So that I know of, that's the only one that can, that'll work. Everything else is never used. No other close relative. It doesn't matter, you know, what it is if they have a common relative or common gotra. But that means that the gotra is different. Right? Because the mother's, how do you say? Mother's come in from somewhere else, so she's a different gotra. Because the boy takes the gotra, the father. So the gotra is different, but they are sapinda. Like that. So the main is Sagotra, that they're not the same line going back to the Prajapatis. That has to be different. Then the finer consideration is they're not Sapinda. They don't have a common relative within six generations. The seventh generation can be common, but not six of them. That's why in the Vedic tradition is that a cultured family knows seven generations of their family line. So you can check if they're Sapinda. Like that. So that's the and then from that, then who has equal nature? That's very important, because if the nature is equal, then the child will be also equally, will be balanced, because from both sides, then they have the same input, so then they'll be the same. Does that make some sense? So that's the essence of appropriate arrangements. You know, then it, you know, you avoid families that are not versed in the Veda, this, that. So, you know, that works okay for, you know, second generation, third generation. First, it's a little tough, you know, like that, because, you know, very few are born, first generation are born into, you know, highly, you know, trained families in the Vedic literatures. You know, it's like not an overly common thing, you know, unless they're from India. But other than that, then... Yeah, it's just saying that's the only place you generally see it, is that they may be like that. But that means that they're actually practicing. It doesn't mean that they're, you know, of a particular varna, but they don't practice. That's not it either. You know, that's not what it means. It means that they're practicing. Okay, then the marriage rites. So then there's eight marriage rites. We assume here they... Brahma, Daiva, Arsha, Prajapatya, Asura, Gandharva, Rakshas, and Paisacha. So then it's divided into two groups, the first four and the last four. The first four, what the common point is they all have the approval of the father. The last four, there's some major tinge of something wrong there.
The girl side.
Yeah. I mean, it always goes back to the girl. It has to be the girl is given away,
right?
Like that. So the arrangements by that. So the first four have that commonality. While the last four, then there's some problem with it. Yasura means the girl is bought by paying, you know, a large sum to the father, you know, of the girl and to the girl herself. Like that. So it's this that's not good. Gandharva means it's just based on sense gratification. There's common lust, so then they get married. Rakshasa means it's not great family, I'd say, interaction. You know, the boy comes into the house, grabs the girl, pulls out his sword, and, you know, and fights with anybody, you know.
It's like Krishna stealing with music.
Yeah, like that. It's this, but I'm just saying it has a little bit of a problem to it, you know. And then the paisacha, that means it's like ghosts, is this, they come and when the girl is, you know, disoriented, inebriated, sleeping or that, then they come and take the girl, like that. So these four are considered bad.
Can you do that physically?
No, I'm saying this is the way the ghosts marry each other.
Oh, I see.
That's why it's called the Asuras, that's how they get married, the Gandharvas, that's how they get married, the Rakshasas, that's how they, this is their right. That's their natural right. So these are all it is these are the eight ways you could get married.
Oh, I see.
Of it, the first four are approved.
So the Gandhara rites, that would be like a modern man.
Yeah.
That's how they do it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's just that. If they just agree, then they're married.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. Like that.
Still, in Gandharva, the marriage ceremony is before the consummation of the relationship, isn't it?
Yeah, it means they've agreed before. It means they'll exchange the garland or something like that. If they're going to marry by Gandharva rite, generally they exchange garlands.
So in the modern society, not even that is observed, because
no, but there's they go down and you know, yeah, it's like they don't. It's just mutual consent. There's no real. It's not understood to be marriage.
Gandharva is like Bhima and Nikadimba. They didn't have a ceremony. They just
it's just an acceptance.
And then they say, yeah, I marry you. You're my wife. And
yeah, no, it's just it's accepted. It's it can be an approved form. Like in Kerala, that's their system of marriage. Families get together, and both sides of the family are there, and they go to an auspicious tree, and the boy and girl sit there, and then they exchange garlands and some little this and that, and then they all go off. You know, yeah, just they all go have prashad. You know, no messing around. I think they exchange garlands, exchange rings. That's it. Sit in a tree, yeah, just like that.
They laugh at when you if you blink you miss the marriage.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. You know, so like that. It's just that's what they follow, you know. So the now of that then the Asura and the Paisach must according to Manu must never be used. Because daughters aren't sold. And it's if you take a gift for the daughter, then you're selling the daughter. So then it's just not done. And the Paisach also is the lowest of the low, so it's also just not done. So the Gandharva and the Rakshasa, those can be practiced by the Kshatriyas. But Prabhupada mentions in Kali Yuga, even they shouldn't use these two rites. So that leaves us in Kali Yuga only with the first four. So the Brahma rite means that the fathers made the arrangements. You know, suitable boys, girl, everything like that. Daiva means that the father is doing a sacrifice and the priest at the marriage, I mean the priest at his sacrifice, he considers suitable for giving his daughter to. He's very pleased with him, and so then he gives his daughter in marriage to the priest. Then the Arsha means that the boy's side of the family approaches the girls and they give some token of respect, a gift of a bull and a cow. But that's for the dog, for the girl, out of respect for the girl, then that's given as a gift for her. The family can't use that. If they take it, then it becomes the Asura right. But if they don't take it, it's just a gift. It means the parents accept it on behalf of the daughter. Like that. So that's how, that's there. Then the Prajapatya, that means the girl, means the first two the father arranges. The third one then means the boy's family arranges. The fourth one means the girl arranges it through her offices. Like you see, there's an element of that. Rukmini, she sent her messenger to Krishna. And then Krishna then came and there was a Rakshasa. Then after that, then they would have the formal Brahma rite. So you see, it's all three marriages were used for Krishna and Rukmini. Like that.
Since you stole our money, we'll give it to you, right?
Yeah, well, no, it's just a matter of he's shown his prowess and everything, and now they want to have a proper arrangement for, like that. It means he could just take her and that's it. And it's done. But because, they're not Rakshasas, so therefore then they want to, they get together, so they go and bring them back, and then call the boy's side of the family, and then they have a big whole hoopla, and like that, because you're establishing a relationship between two families. But the Rakshasas, you stole the girl, and haribol, that's
is,
it.
Is there degrees of benefit for doing
yeah.
different...
That comes up here, qualities of the rites. Means, by the four good, that are called the, what do you call it? They don't have any faults. The first four have no faults, so those children will be faultless. Without faults.
Proper.
They're proper. They're faultless. So then the children will be like that. The last four have faults in them, so the children will have faults. And then of the faultless, then the Brahma rite, the son, if the marriage is proper according to equal and everything like that, and the son grows up as a practicer of the Vedic culture, then he can say he'll save 21 generations. Like that. The Daiva rite, then he'll save 15 generations. 21 means 10 in the past, 10 in the future, and himself. So that's 21.
Save means?
By performing the Shraddha rites and all that, then he'll benefit them. Depending upon what they are. If they're karmakandis, it'll be that. If it's other, you know, like that. But they benefit. I can't say they'll get moksha, because if they're karmakandis, they're not interested in that in any way. But in any way, he would save them from hell, at least, like that. Because that's also considered a liberation. So then the Daiva would be 15 generations, 7 past, 7 future in themselves. The Arsha rite is 7, 3 in the past, 3 in the future in themselves. And the Prajapatya then would be 13, 6 in the past, 6 in the future in themselves. So it's interesting to note that whether the father or the daughter arrange the marriage, those are better than if the boy arranges the marriage. Because the difference being is the girl or the girl's side of the family has approached the boy. So that puts the boy in a strong position. The boy's family has approached the girl, that puts the girl in a strong position. So it means they're all bona fide, but it just means that it's not as strong like that. But the point is that it should be arranged. You know, because the point is if the girl is attached to the boy, then she'll be surrendered. Because she's surrendered, then she'll get a son who has the qualities of submission, like that. So it just makes it a little bit more powerful. That's why they make these distinctions, like that. Then honor of women, that women are to be respected, and by respecting the women, then things go nicely. If women are disrespected, then all difficulty comes up. Like we see that the two biggest wars in the world were created over women, right? Ravana and, you know, Draupadi. So we see that these two, they were the biggest, you know, but it was because of insulting women. So because of that, then everything was finished. Like that. Everything was finished. Then so they must be taken care of, must be respected, must be dealt with nicely. You know, because if they're chaste, then they're very powerful. Insulting them, then, is a big problem.
What, and within marriage, if you fight with your wife and stuff like that, is it kind of the same?
It depends upon what's the purpose. You know, it means there shouldn't be a fight. You know? Because ideally, then the man knows how to deal with the woman, and the woman knows how to behave. So technically, there shouldn't be a fight, though there may be fights. But Prabhupada said that fighting is like goats. You ever seen goats fight?
Yeah.
Yeah. As soon as you come up and get close, yeah, they butt their heads together. But as soon as you come up to them like this, they immediately run off. So it's not very serious, because they lose that anger and all that immediately. So a lot of times, it's just more of a chivalry. But dogs fighting, that's real. They're fighting in that. You can come up, kick them, beat them with sticks, this, that. They won't even notice you there. They're absorbed. They are actually fighting.
Right.
So Prabhupada said, you know, in family life, they do fight as like goats. It's not really meaning anything. It's just a difference of opinion. And it is like that. But one should be careful. Like that. One should be careful. At the same time, one should learn to control them without having to fight like that, you know, because it's not a question of equals. The husband is the senior, so you don't fight with seniors, and seniors don't fight with juniors. You know, it's below them to fight with juniors, and it's improper to fight with seniors. So therefore, technically, what is there, just disagreements on application and stuff like that, some detail and this and that. You know, so it's not a problem.
I think Prabhupada mentioned that in a marriage, if there's a fight, it's normal. If there's no fight, then
that's special.
There's something wrong.
Yeah, oh.
For a man and a boy, for a husband and wife, it's natural in the course of life.
Yeah. Well, it means it depends on what kind of fighting.
Not fighting.
Yeah, quarreling. There'd be, because there's always a chivalry between men and women. There's always the thing of who's in control. So you'll always have that little bit. It's in fact, it's kind of fun, you know, but it'll stay like that, you know. But if it gets really serious, then one has to be more careful.
I mean, a lot of grihastas say that after the fight, the relationship becomes more, like, you know, for some time, everything becomes all nice and...
Yeah, because then they think about it.
It's a kind of strengthens the bonds or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's more positive kind of fighting than...
Yeah, that's the point. They're not trying to... They're both well-wishers of each other. So therefore, it's their purpose is for the other's benefit, you know. But if it's actually they're trying to disturb or hurt each other, then that's not progressive.
My father was on that walk. He was in Vrindavan. Srila Prabhupada said if they were talking about, you know, the relationship of the husband and the wife, and everyone was putting their two cents in, Srila Prabhupada said you know, it's important to keep the wife happy. They said, but if your wife is too happy, the chances are the husband is doing something wrong. And then he left. If the wife is too happy, chances are the husband is doing something wrong.
Something wrong meaning?
Not exactly. I mean, sure, he's not being, you know...
too happy meaning that she's in control.
She's really happy. She's either in control or the husband.
I think in Kama Sutra Maharaj, there is one shloka where it explains that if the wife is too dutiful and too nice, it means that she's doing something funny also. Uh-huh. She is a paramour or something.
Uh-huh.
When there is the normal attitude where she is doing everything too perfect and too nice and too good and no, you know, staying away from your wife, means there is something going on there. So.
Prabhupada gives that example. That she would be very attentive to her duties in the house if she has a lover.
That's why we should do our duty in material life. Because we have Krishna.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he's the actual. It's the same principle. It's like. It's also the explanation of Raga Nuka Bhakti.
Mm-hmm.
Is that one does the duties even better. So one would think that the Kanista is doing the duties and the Madhyama doesn't. No, the Madhyama doesn't better than the Kanista, even though he's on Raga rather than Vaidhi. So that's sometimes taken as a mistake, is that those who are performing rag bhakti, then they don't need to follow the rules. No, it's only the uttama doesn't need to follow, you know. But if he's preaching, he will, because he'll act as a madhyama, because preacher means madhyama. So they'll follow the rules even better.
And Prabhupada, I think, mentioned there also in Chaitanya Charitamrita that at a higher stage, you behave like a girl that is sneaking away with the lover. That on the outside you're showing everything prima and proper, but the love to Krishna that you have, you really hide it because you don't want to show it to them.
Yeah, you don't show.
The girl doesn't want to show that she has a lover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very important point. Is that it's not shown. You know, no one sees, no one thinks. That's the thing, is that, like Rupa Goswami, there's only one incident where they can say that he was manifesting any ecstatic symptoms like that. Mm-hmm. Only once. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that once was enough to understand that it was serious. He's not rolling in the ground, just that. Just Raghunath Bhatta, he would always read Bhagavatam, and there came a certain verse in that, and this Rupa Goswami fell unconscious. And some of them went near him to help, and his breath then, you know, fell on the person's leg and it burnt him. So then they could understand that separation was so severe at that. Because it said is that you have three examples of emotion. One is cotton in a wind. So the littlest breeze, the cotton will move. Then you have a stone in a puddle. You know, you drop it and then, you know, it'll make ripples. And then the third is the mountain in the ocean. So it's in the ocean, but the waves and all that, but it doesn't move. So then that's always the recommended. Okay, so then degradation of the family is if one gives up one's duties.
Can I just ask one thing?
Yeah.
Because it's this modern concept about emotions, they say that like if you repress, if you don't show your emotions, that
well, this is transcendental we're talking about.
But even on the material plane, isn't it recommended that one should kind of be calm and you know, not blow his top every time, you know.
That's what it's supposed to be. See, is that if you're dealing with people who are untrained and don't have any standards, then if for them to show their emotions would be natural for them. But for someone who is trained, it's unnatural to show them. You know, I mean, what's the difference between a human and a dog? You upset a dog, he'll bite you. You upset a human being who's common, he'll you know, somehow or another deal roughly with you. But you deal with somebody who's, you know, trained, then they won't. You know, they're tolerant and this and that, and they see that there's no importance in that. Like that. They may never deal with you again. That may be there. But it doesn't mean that they won't, that they'll deal roughly. Like that. So that's part. So there's all these things, this modern showing emotion and all this, this is all coming from, I would say, from women psychiatrists in that call field.
You're from Hollywood.
Huh?
You're from Hollywood.
Yeah, well, because they have to attend to women or those attached to them. You're not dealing with detachment and austerity and those things. Because the woman's world is emotion, that's all it is. Everything's emotion, there's not something else going on there. You don't have pure intellectualism or pure sensuality. You know, it is everything's emotion. It doesn't matter what they're doing. Even they're listening to a lecture, there's an emotional element there that they like the person speaking, they like how they're speaking, they like, you know, so it's to them they're still getting some kind of taste of relationship out of it. Like that. Though it may be predominantly intellectual or predominantly emotional or predominantly sensual, but for them it's all three the same. So to not show emotion for them is strange. You know, man can say things, you know, just without emotion. And it doesn't mean anything to women. Like when men sit around and talk, and they're just joking and laughing, they can be dealing with things that are purely intellectual. You know, you take, men can sit around and joke about, taking something and using intelligence and finding more and more absurd ways to put it together or express it. And they'll take great pleasure in that because it's just an exercise of the intelligence. Women think it's the most stupid thing they ever heard of. You know, they think it's so stupid. But then women sit around and everything they talk about is all mixed with some emotion. And so if you hear them talking, pure?
Pure nonsense.
Yeah. And for the men, they hear this and go, this is stupid.
That's why my wife doesn't appreciate my sense of humor.
Yeah, that's right. That's the whole point. That's why you don't appreciate their blabbing on and on and on and on and on and on and on.
I say something, you know, like, you know, chocolate sauce with olives in it.
Huh?
I say something, you know, chocolate sauce with olives, you know.
Yeah, and they'll go, what? That's terrible. Because it immediately creates, it creates from the sensual that's translated into emotion. So it's bad. So it just creates a bad thing. You know, it's just like, it means you can never always tell where it will be. But anything gross, then it always freaks the ladies out. Though they can deal with certain gross things and be completely in ecstasy, you know, like changing diapers and stuff like that. So, like that. But, you know. You know, you can say mucus, you can't say snot.
Right.
You know, stuff like that. So that's the principle, is that it has to be gentle and nice so it gives a pleasant emotional experience. So that's the thing, is that there's no emotion in what the men are saying, and it's bizarre. It's going out of all the ways and this and that. And, you know, somebody says something and that was funny, and then someone takes it to the next level and makes it more absurd, and then they laugh. And someone then finds another way to put it together that's even more absurd, like that. And, you know, so the men have great fun with that because they're just using the intelligence, you know. Mm-hmm. Or if the men are emotional, purely emotional, women will, it's nice. But they'll think that they're stupid. So generally, when the men get really emotional, the women will take the leading position.
Right.
Because they are emotional and they can still think. They're still intellectual while they're emotional.
Right.
like that. That's the thing. So they'll always take the lead there.
Yeah, they tend to think of them as kind of strange.
Yeah, it's like that, it's okay, it's emotional, it's like that, it's nice, they're showing, they appreciate, but at the same time, is they kind of, it draws from them more of a motherly mood, like that, that they take care, so it throws it into parental rasa, technically.
Hmm. It's funny, because they always complain that men aren't emotional, and aren't sentimental, and when they are...
They say this too, because the point is that's why it says the four times is clever, because... In the practicalness of the family scene, which is emotional, their intellect works. Because when the man's intellect works, it's not functioning with the emotions. You can consider emotions, but it's not working in the emotional field. It's working in the intellectual field. So this makes a difference, like that. And knowing this, then one understands how they're put together and how they're not. What's favorable and not. So the men have to know that women are like this, and so they'll always attend and deal in that way. So the way they speak will never go, it will grate, you know, with them because of its roughness or coarseness or lack of sensitivity. So the point is, say whatever you like, but say it in a sensitive way, and then you can say anything. If it's said in a sensitive way, you know, in a proper tone of voice, even the most roughest, heaviest, you know, things can be said, but because the mood is right, then they'll take it, because that's the realm their intellect works in. It sounds like, what's the importance? Why not just be straight? Because if it's straight, then it only catches their intellect and not their emotions. So they consider you didn't understand, because emotion is the field. When you understand the emotion, you understood. You understand the situation or not? Okay, that's nice. But they explain the situation so you understand the emotion. Man explains the situation so that you can understand how to give a solution. Right? Woman explains the field so you understand the emotion. Like that. That's why it's just a matter of, if the emotion can be changed or appreciated, then that's what they're trying to get. Right? Man's looking for a solution to the problem, but the woman's problem is an emotional problem. It's not actually the problem. It's the emotions have been disturbed by that problem. So if you can adjust the emotions and make them feel better, then without solving the problem's been solved. Their problem's been solved. And if their problem's solved, your problem's solved. So therefore, don't worry about it, that it's got to be solved, you know, in a manly way. No, the men know that this is the way women are, so they solve it in that way for them. You just listen, this and that, and, you know, and just you're pleasant. And then you've told the whole field from 20 different angles. And then, you know, it's an exaggeration, it's actually 10, but... You know, then they feel that you understand, and then having that you've understood, the problem just evaporates like the morning fog and the sun, and the man is left standing there wondering, what was that? You know, what did that have to do with reality? You know, like that.
If you can distract them and get them onto another topic.
If you can, but you can't. But it has to be done through emotion. But if you just sit and listen long enough, they'll distract themselves, like that, because their emotions aren't stable. So it's only because no one understands, and they're suffering so much, and they want to share that with somebody. Then, if you sit there and listen, they've shared it with you now, because they've shared. For them, that's a positive thing. So they feel happy. So just automatically, it's like, if you can tolerate sitting there, it's self-repairing. You know, they come in with a problem that you just think, this is impossible to correct. But you just sit there for 45 minutes or half an hour or 1 hour, whatever is the greatness of it. You know, it means it's either, you know, the Titanic sank or World War I has started, or, you know, the cosmic creation is about to end. Whatever, depending on the length, the greatness of it. Then you just sit there and pay attention, and then you'll find at the end of it, it's been shared. That's the whole point. They just want to share their difficulty.
I think also in there they feel like they've got a love And they, but simply by speaking it out.
Yeah. Then it's gone.
Because it's going around in the air.
Yeah.
Going round when you speak.
It's got, yeah. When it comes out of the mouth, then
it's gone.
Yeah. So that's the yeah. So like that. So it's so that's because the value system is different. Theirs is the emotions, while man it's the logic, you know. So like that. So the women, that's the strength. I mean, that their strength is in the emotional field. The men's strength is in the intellectual field.
When we have a problem, we'll analyze it logically and come to some sort of solution.
Yeah.
Okay, but they cannot.
It's bouncing because it's just emotions against emotions. The problems with happiness, two incompatible emotions have bumped into each other. You know, that may have been generated by the situation, but the same woman that they say is, you know, this and that, you'll see in the next day, best of friends. So it doesn't make any sense. All it was is that it happened to be the situation, whatever is there, that they take as real, and they, you know, criticize and this and that. But if that problem's gone and the emotions are working, then it doesn't matter. You know, so it's not based on logic. It simply means if you understand that the logic is the emotion, the natural flow of emotion, or the positive transformation of one into another, then that's what it's looking for. So anything that creates an obstacle to that, throws it off that track, then that will be what's considered bad. Well, for the man, it must be logical and all that. That's considered good. And something that's just emotional or just, you know, like that is bad. So they have to work it out that it all matches, it's not contradictory, and that then that's good for them. And if there's contradictory or something that doesn't add up, then...
What's about the Brahma Charini who says, I never want to get married, I don't want kids, totally talks logic.
I want or I don't want?
She doesn't want to get married, she doesn't want to have kids, she just want to be on the...
If she can do it, then nice.
But that's all logic. No, it's, logic.
No, it's not. How did you just say it?
Well, because...
No, but you didn't catch it. Here's a man. Yeah, you know, thinking about it, there's nothing to gain there, so I wouldn't want to get married or have children. Right? Any emotion there? No. What, but if you're saying, I don't want to get married, I don't want to have children, it's emotion.
Could just be a negative...
Yeah, they feel like that. It may be that means there's more intellect there, and they've analyzed it, but that generates an emotion. That's the point, is that they're still going to function as women. So even their brahmacharini, they don't want to get married like that, and they function much more on the intellectual platform. Still, you have to present that intellectual platform in a emotionally compatible way, because they still are women. So you may have reduced that feminineness from, you know, a real wild, girly, whirly kind of stuff down to something that's, it's just a little rough for the men. You know, it just now and again bubbles off and does something strange, but then you can immediately bring it back. But still, it'll happen because they're women.
So Mahabharata is too much. That's why it's got so many emotions in it.
Yeah, that's why it's their thing. You know, they love it. You know, they love the Mahabharata. It's very interesting to note who is, you know, most enthusiastic about hearing the Mahabharata. Like that. And that's one of the things that the girls love it, hearing the Mahabharata.
I have to admit I also.
Yeah. Like that. Because it has that, you know, the virtue and the show like that. So everybody can get what they want from it. That's it's so actually written. But it's like Brahmin Kshatriyas, they'll consider that that's nice, that everyone will like that, but at the same time there's also other things they could study and get a taste out of. Like the Brahmin, they could get a taste out of Upanishads or Vedanta. And out of that, because it has the knowledge in that and application for the Brahmins. It has that knowledge application. It has that mood of chivalry and virtue and, you know, proper things done for the Kshatriyas. It has morality and these fine qualities for the Vaishya. You know, and you always see profit and loss. The Shudras, then it's the emotion and the interaction and the, you know, the relationships like that. Women will be the same. Like that. So it comes out, everybody, it's so perfectly written that everybody likes it. you know, and all the four ashrams, you see brahmacharis, grihasthas, vanaprastha. So it's like, it is the perfect, basically, well, it's not exactly mundane, but it's that, it's the perfect literature in which everybody can relate to. And at the same time as there is the spiritual message. But the spiritual message is not as prominent due to its using that method of addressing everybody. Like that. Well, Bhagavatam then just cuts all that out and just is the same thing, same stories practically. But it's from the perspective not of the emotion and the religious and all that, as much as the spiritual, and it drops, it puts in the religious, but in its connection to the spiritual, not just religious for religious. You know, like the Pandavas are always talking about going to the heavens and all that. They're the devotees, but it's just part of the rasa. You know, they all talk like that. But in Bhagavatam, then, you know, except certain stories, they don't talk like that. Like that. Some they are, because, you know, you want to get the perspective on the things, and then how you know, somebody's in one way, someone's in another, and you can get the contrast. So it's like, you know, and the general feature is story. So this is law as it is, in its just pure form. So Mahabharata is everything that's in here, the Dharma Shastra, will be in Mahabharata, but exemplified through a different through the pastimes and the interaction between the devotees. So then it comes out good. Does that make some sense? Mm.
Like that. However, it's sometimes difficult to catch if you don't have the basis of
understanding. Yeah, it means, well, if you know, you'll get it from the stories, and if you have that virtuous mood and you're trained, then you'll come. These things will come up. You've heard them so many times. And then others can give example, you know, the parents, the grandparents, others can all say, you know, just like Draupadi did this, and just like Arjuna did that, and you know, so many things. You know, Bhima is complaining like this, and then Yudhishthira is saying this. And so they're all presenting principles of the Dharma Shastra. But then you see which is higher. Like what Yudhishthira says is the highest. And generally what Bhima and Draupadi present, if they're not pleased with the situation that they're living in the forest, these are secondary considerations. They're true. And if someone's on that level, that's there. Sometimes they present atheistic. Draupadi does it. But then the actual way you should look at it is there. So you even get in the discussion. So it's like the purport on it. You know, you could present, that's one of the things is in the Tatparyalinga is Panchanga Nyaya, is you make a point, then you have to give the opposition and their methods, then you have to defeat that and then give the conclusion. So it's common.
In your own presentation?
Yeah, in your own presentation. This is standard presentation. That's why you see so much Prabhupada says, some may say, or he'll take the scientists, right, the materialists, or the, you know, the dogmatic practitioners of Vedic culture, or he'll take what is the opposing party and what is their philosophy or purposes or methods, or, you know, whatever is the point being discussed, and then he'll present that and then defeat it and then give the conclusion in bhakti. So then in there, in the story, you'll have this going on in a conversation, you're presenting it. But you're having, one party is presenting the Siddhanta and the other is done by someone else, rather than it's just a lecture or just a row of verses, you know, like that. Then it has that dynamics there.
Also Maharaj, in the stories, when some law is given in a story, for simple folk and others, they don't question.
Yeah.
They will accept that this comes from higher authority, and it is like that, then we follow it like that. Why? Who cares? It is like that, then therefore we follow it like that. So for us, like my grandparents were like that, and they didn't know how to explain that that's how it is. For younger generations, we questioned it, and it doesn't work. But like the same in India, all the simple folk in India, they know all the laws and regulations. They don't know why. But in their folk stories, in their sayings, in their proverbs, it's all there also. But they just don't go deeper to see what is behind it, or if I don't do it, this will happen. or is not important, because they don't see value in it. We just follow it for, that's how we follow it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's important.
But that's why the new generation doesn't follow, because yes, they don't know the value.
Yeah, they don't know it, so they can't get across. So the bond isn't that strong between the generations that you'll just be simple like them and just accept it because they accept it. Mm-hmm. If the bond is that strong, then they do it, I do it.
Right.
But if that bond isn't that strong, then they may doubt, because there's two different worlds. Mm-hmm. You know, you have the modern, and then you have this, you know, traditional culture. Like that. So the modern is always based on the science and this from observation. You know, they start from what you can see, mm-hmm. then you speculate on it, then you come up with a conclusion. Like that. But you've made the conclusion based on your values. Well, the Vedic system is you start off with the conclusion that's given to us by authority. Then from that you contemplate it, and you bring it to the point where you can practically see it in your life. You can use it. You can explain it to others. You see it like that, and you can make others see it like that. So it's just opposite, it's reverse. So that's the difficulty, is that it gets lost, because the parents can't explain it, so, and the children are exposed to this reverse method, so it throws up a doubt. You know, because it throws a doubt on authority, though it's based on authority, because that scientist now will write something, and what he writes is supposed to be now the Shabda,
right,
the authority. You know, and then you're supposed to just, you know, hear from that and then go through the other way. But it was gotten to by the wrong method, so it also then creates students that have the same method. So then they will, with time, then throw out their teacher, and then they'll present their own thesis. You know, it's just like it. You go to any university now, and those who are the younger teachers and PhDs, they have a whole different opinion on the subject, but they can't present it strongly, because the ones in the seat in the faculty are in the previous generation, and they have their own thing. But already that field has moved ahead 20 years. And that the professor in the seat many times hasn't, because he's the authority, and he gets stuck, but there's new things come up. So then they want to move on and throw it out. So they may in their classroom tell their students like that, but they can't officially deal like that. So then they have to wait until that generation clears out, and then they can finally say what they want. But by that time, then it's already moved on again. You know, you know. So that's the whole.
It's a problem with the ascending process.
Yeah, that's the problem. It's always changing, because it's subjective. Because it ascends, it starts from your point of view, and then you take that up to, you know, finer and finer points. But it's already started off with yours, your opinion. Well, the other, it starts with God's opinion, and then comes down to us. It's superior. But unfortunately, not necessarily popular. Yeah. Yeah. So then the family can be degraded by, you know, improper dealings with the women going bad, giving up the Vedic practices, not studying, you know, taking up forbidden occupations, marrying the wrong girl, you know, who's not of compatible or equal nature. You know, so all those kind of things can degrade the family. Like that. So then that brings us to topic 8. Now the married person, now he has five sacrifices that he has to perform. So then we can see them here. Prahuta is Balidan, Brahmanyahuta is giving alms and feeding guests, Prasita is the Shraddha rites. Okay, and then there's two. Okay, prasita. Prahuta is the Balidan. Brahmanyahuta is the Brahmins. Prasita is the mains. Then you have one to the sages and to the demigods. So they'll have to perform there also, there, whatever is their method of sacrifice. So then in you know, in the procedures for worship, then they also explain what's valuable for us. We'll go into, it's just the method of certain aspects of serving prasad, proper ways of dealing and stuff like that. You know, it's like the pot has to be carried with two hands. No one can say, I can carry it with one hand. But what happens if something happens? Mm-hmm. What if the pot breaks? What if it slips? Mm-hmm. You know, you can't say that it was a successful program when you drop the pot of dal, it's smashed on the ground and then splattered all over your guests. Right. So, because that would be most appropriate, then the rule is that the pot has to be carried both hands. And if it's a pot, if it's got a handle, of course, if it's a bucket, you can use one hand. But even then, you'd still use two. You'd hold the spoon in one hand, the bucket in the other. So all these things is what would make it work nicely. So there's little things like that. So that is explained, that we would use. But outside of that, then basically, for us, if you worship the Supreme Lord, then worship the demigods, the sages, the forefathers, everybody's already taken care of. So then for us, it's just the culture of, you know, feeding Vaishnavas and like that. And performing and our yuga dharma, then that's your sacrifice. So it's sacrifice has to be performed. So instead of this one for the demigods, you're doing the one for the Supreme Lord. So that replaces that. Study the shastras. You study the shastras connected to transcendental, like that. You feed the Vaishnavas, like that. And then the forefathers are already taken care of. You worship the guru; they're all taken care of. Like that, because that's the real forefathers. Then mode of gaining subsistence. So the principle is that it should cause little or no pain to others how you gain your money. And you should only gear means this is the snatic, so that means the Brahman. This is just gaining the bare necessities, just what it takes to live. You know, whatever for him is, you know, just comfortable, it's okay, he lives at that. He doesn't go beyond, unless just it comes in on his own. Then he may live more opulently. But if it doesn't, he's not going to work for it. He's going to work for just what gets it done. Like that. Hmm. You know. If in his little bit of work he gets a lot, that's another thing. But he won't expand his work to expand his field of facility. Because there's too much to be done. There's too much to study, too much to teach, too much to preach, too much, sadhana and all these other things. It just can't be compromised for economics. Like that. Six modes of subsistence. So that means it's either ritta, which means truth, means gleaning the fields, picking up the grains from the fields or from the marketplace that nobody wants. It's dropped on the ground. Like that, when they close the market, you always see grains and stuff on the ground. So they'll come to there, sweep it all up, and then take it and clean it. You know, separate what's on the ground into the different things, and then use that. Or they're threshing the grains in the field, and so always some is dropped. So you come up and sweep the bare ground and collect that grains, and then like that. So that's ritta. Then mritta means death. That means begging. Because by that it humbles you. So that's like death. Then you have amrita, which means nectar, which means you just accept what comes without asking. Like that. So you just perform your duties, don't worry about it. Like Sudama Brahman seemed to have practiced amrita. He didn't go out and beg and stuff. He just, you know, what came. So that's why he sometimes had nothing. Pramrita means many deaths, so that's agriculture. Because by that, when you plow the fields, this, that, you know, so many bugs get killed and so many things like that. But it is the duty of the Vaishya to farm. So therefore, even though, you know, so many bugs, this, that, are being killed, it's their duty, so therefore it doesn't matter. You know, just like the Kshatriya may have to kill in the performance of his duty. He has to kill criminals or fight, kill other warriors, but it's his duty. You know, or in the Vedic age, the Brahmins, and they had to perform this animal sacrifice, so animals would be killed, but it's their duty, so then it would work. You know, it wouldn't. There's no sin. So therefore, for Vaishyas, farming, there's no sin in the living entities being killed, because that is their duty. While Brahmins and Kshatriyas wouldn't take it as a first option. Right? It means for the Vaishyas, they would take cow protection and agriculture as their first option. Mm-hmm. And business and banking as second options. But for the Brahmin and Kshatriya, if they had to accept Vaishya duties to maintain themselves, they would take business as the first option. And farming as the second option. Like that. But they would only sell those things generally that people need. They wouldn't sell stuff that creates illusion and stuff like that. You know, that kind of a thing. They just think, you know, practical stuff that people really need. Like that. Of course, people think they need a lot of things.
They think they need toilet paper.
Yeah.
Water paper. Toilet paper roller holders. You go into the, you know, one of these compartment stores, there like, you know, 50 different types of you know, the thing that you holds the toilet paper.
Oh yeah.
50 different types of toilet paper.
Yeah. One of the most interesting I saw once was toilet paper that on each square it had a face of the American temple president, the American president. I forget who it was. It was somebody they didn't like, you know. They had his some people
to Bush.
Yeah, it may have been. No, this was just somebody that everybody, no one was really pleased. There's been many presidents that are like that, no one really appreciated them. You know, as people.
Japanese paint on toilet paper English courses to study in.
Practical, I guess.
Spend a lot of time
there. Yeah, especially if it's all, you know, keeps going. If it keeps repeating, that's another thing that you just keep going. All roll on the floor, right? You've read the whole thing. That's funny. Okay, that's pramrita. Then satyanrita, that's business. Satyanrita means, satya means truth, and I guess an means lie. So it's half truth, half lie. Like that. I mean, because, you know, it has to be done properly and everything. You know, what you're selling is proper. But at the same time, as you can't tell the guy, yeah, this cost me, you know, $95 and I'm selling it to you. You can't tell him that. I mean, I saw once one businessman, a devotee here, he ran the temple shop, and he's basically one of his best friends. The best friend says, you know, hey, give me a discount. You know, this. Oh, no, he didn't start off with a discount. He said, how much for this? And he said, you know, because it's you, I'll give it to you for 100 rupees. He said, no, 80, this, that. He says, hey, no, it cost me 100 rupees. I'm giving it to you cost price. You know, I've sent my man, I've gone all over India, we've gotten it and all that. So, you know, we've done the service. So therefore, I'm not making profit. He wouldn't believe him because he said, you're just saying that, you know. And he gave him 80 rupees. And he was telling him, don't give me 80 rupees, you keep it. He says, I'll give it to you for free, or you can ask me for a discount, and I give you the discount. But I'm not going to take less. You know, so I think he just gave it to him. Because, you know, somehow or another they did. You just don't believe that he would tell. So that's why then, from then on, he would always tell him, you know, if he wanted to give it to him for 100, you know, he would tell him 120. You know, because okay, then 100, you know, then he's happy, okay, you know. Because he just wouldn't believe that he would tell the truth. So from that on, he didn't. You can't tell the truth. You know, they just won't believe. Because the point is, the businessman doesn't tell truth. So if he did, no one would believe it anyway. You know, so therefore you can't. You know, maybe to another businessman you could. But to someone who's not, then... And then the last one, shvabrita, means you serve someone else, you assist someone else, you assist somebody who's practicing these other, like that. So then the dvijas should be independent because they have to be able to generate, and then the shudras, they assist those three because then they're taken care of. Because unless somebody's independent, then others can't be taken care of. You know, if everybody's, you know, dependent, then the, you know, who's going to, you know, make it work? And if everybody is independent, then it's all right as long as there's no economics, you know,
right.
Because otherwise you can't run a big shop alone. You have to have assistance. You have to, you know, anything takes assistance. So like that, then those are the six ways that you can take care of yourself. So let them never follow the ways of the world. So even though the rest of the world does whatever they do, he knows what he's supposed to do, does that. Then he'll be happy, because then, this is the point, contentment as the root of happiness. Happiness is contentment.
Right.
Because otherwise happiness is fleeting. I'll be happy when I get this. You get that, then you have a moment of happiness. Then the happiness is gone. Mm-hmm. Now you need something else, because if you're going to be happy, you have to, it's attainment of something. So by gaining it, you become happy. But if what you already have, you're happy, it means you've already gained. You know what I'm saying? The point of gaining is where the happiness is. But what you have, you're happy with, then you're always working on the principle of having received. Because the gain is at a moment in time. You know what I'm saying? Now I want this. Then you endeavor for it, and then that moment comes where it arrives. That's the moment of happiness. Then that moment passes, it's the past. So then you can't be happy with the past. You know, you can only be happy with the present. So therefore you look for another thing in the future which will eventually arrive in the present. So satisfaction means you just freeze it in the present. Because you have it and it's here. So whatever you have, you're satisfied. So you actually can be happy that way. So if one's content, then that's the best. So we see here the snatika, he has to be content. And one of the elements of the women is whatever the husband provides, they have to be content. The husband, the father, the son, whoever they're dependent on. What they provide, they have to be content.
Does it not also matter the happiness with what we're doing rather with what we're getting?
Yeah. That's another, that's, yes, that's the taking you to the step, is that happy that we're in the proper performance, that we're doing our duties to the best we can, not like what we're going to get out of it.
That kind of satisfaction can actually only come from the mode of goodness, right?
Yeah, that's the point, because the present is mode of goodness, future is passion, past is ignorance, you know, which is really interesting, because in Sanskrit, I don't know what the future is called. But past tense is bhavishya, but the past tense is bhutakal.
Bhutakal.
Yeah.
Ghost time.
Bhutakal, yeah, it means because the bhutas, so it's the ignorance, lamentation, or bhuteshvara. There's two kinds of past. There's one that means past meaning from yesterday back, and then there's a past means from now back. So then, you get that thing, so it's either Shiva or the ghost, like that. So it has that element. Past has that ignorance, and future is passion. The present is goodness. So if one's living in the present, one's living in goodness. We can only do that by proper knowledge.
Yeah. Like that.
So satisfaction is the actual root of happiness. If that's there, one's always happy. Because whatever you have, you're happy with. So that means you're always happy. That's the nice thing about it. Yes.
So, if I connected with the class before, you had, when you were talking about the austerity of each varna.
Mm-hmm.
So then it's put as an austerity, but then we understood that a person that is in that austerity, that is his.
Yeah, that position. Is his position.
So then it also would help to find out if someone is in what varna you are, or what you're doing, what is giving you satisfaction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That is your.
Yeah.
And that is your austerity, even though it's giving you happiness.
Yeah.
So someone who is struggling in that position, which is really an austerity for him, is he's not really for that place.
Yeah, it's not there. He could do it as emergency, but it's best to situate them where it can be stable. Because otherwise it will drop at some point.
It really becomes austerity. It's not
there. They'll drop it. And so then it's a temporary solution. But if there's an emergency, then that can always be done.
Mm-hmm.
But one has to judge who it is and what's their austerity. You know, but how long it'll last. Mm. You know, because otherwise it's an emergency, so someone, the authority puts that on someone who can do it but is actually just unsuitable for it in that position, and it works, and because it solved their problem, then they don't bother looking for another person, because that's a problem, to actually replace them, like that. So then it just goes on to the point they can't handle it anymore, then they drop out, then the problem arises, then you find the next one. So, you know, they wait until after it's happened, rather than plan it that, okay, I have to find another person anyway, because this person will burn out. So let me take this time to find a good person, rather than just some emergency that I got to find somebody today to do it. Mm-hmm. So I have, okay, the person can last 3 months. Okay, then I have 3 months to find. Mm-hmm. You know, then you put in the person that lasts, then that person's happy, and the person that's been taken off of it's happy also. But the other way is that you just keep losing. You know, you have one person, you keep losing one, rather than having two satisfied people. Okay. Yeah, okay. Then you have this... yeah, because that brings us to duties of the snaka. Any questions? More? Any other questions or points on this?
Among these six modes of gaining subsistence, which one is the topmost? First one?
Ruta.
Ruta.
Means gleaning the field. This is for a Brahmin. Mm-hmm. I mean, Kshatriya, no. You know, because they should protect the people and by the power of their arms, and they take tax. That's mm-hmm. what they should do. But for the Brahmins, then they can use... easy. So gleaning from the fields is considered the best, because there is endeavor and you're independent. Mm-hmm. Amrita, many times we see those who are on very elevated platform follow that one, because they don't even bother with that. But the difficulty is with Amrita, is you may receive guests from people who are unqualified to give. You know, people who have attained money by improper means. You know, the character's not good in that. So then when receiving guests from them, you take karma. So then you have to know is that if it's coming from a bad source, it can be used for dependence or given in charity to qualified people. But you can't use it for yourself. So that's why then the Ritta is, you know, it's active while the other one's passive. So then you might turn into laziness. So if you've replaced that economic endeavor with spiritual endeavor, then giving it up is not a problem, like that. But otherwise, if not, you just don't endeavor with something higher, and at the same time just work on whatever comes. When it takes some tolerance, but it also could be laziness. Mm-hmm. So it's the others are very easy to define. Amrit is harder to define, because it could be used by elevated persons, it could be used by low-grade persons. You know, what you get can be excellent, what you get can be not excellent.
If you use that for Krishna service, then you don't get
it. Yeah, then it's no problem. It means it can be used, devotees will use like that, because then it also has the element that it's like that of service. Yeah. It means you're working for the Lord and whatever He gives you, so you're like a dependent. So then it puts one technically in the position like a servant. Mm-hmm. You know, that's therefore the name Das. Like that. So the topmost brahminical level looks similar to the Shudra. But he's not Shudra for anybody, he's Shudra for God. Right? And then the Shudras serve that person. That's considered the best. That'll come up. The best service of a Shudra is to Brahmins. That's always the first option. If you can't get that, then serve a Kshatriya. If not that, then a righteous Vaishya. And if you can't do that, then take up trades, you know, trade, crafts, mechanics, you know, things that are useful for the community. That shouldn't be sinful, just something that's useful. Like that. Then he's basically independent, because he can't find somebody that just doesn't work. Then he can do like that. But it's always that's the best, is because then by that association one will be elevated. That's the principle. So you always then put yourself in what's the best position. Like the king always has Brahmins around. The Vaishyas always invite Brahmins. You know, like that. So then it works very nicely. Is that principle of that association then is always there.
Well, that principle can be applied in present time in a practical way.
What?
Rita.
As devotees, then, I mean, so basically, we would use more just whatever we get. We would work on more on Amrita. If you're like in the temple doing temple service, so whatever prasad they give you, that's what you get. You know, whatever the clothes, whatever this, that, and you just do. Or you take what no one wants. You know, there's always in the temple a closet full of everything that nobody wants. You just go in there and dig out, and you find all kinds of stuff. You take that and wash it, and then. So that's also Rita, or, you know, taking what's left, you know, don't jump to the front of the line, just at the back. And, you know,
help
works. Yeah, like that. So, like that. The main principle is that you're not inconveniencing anybody. And the other Amrita means is you're just taking whatever you're given. Like that, but both have the same principle. Both have the same principle. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. You said that the these are down to the minimum because you want to keep most of your time for the state.
Yeah, because it's said that for a Brahmin that he should always study. He should never compromise his study for economics. Like that. He has to work his economics around his study and teaching. Like that. He can't do it the other way. That's why you see is that they teach in the morning and in the evening, and at noontime they go out begging. You know? Because in that time they go out begging, that's brought home, that's prepared for lunch, they go take their bath. You know, they have lunch, and then after lunch and they start classes again. So you'll find many, then they work by that, the begging principle. Begging, they don't bother Amrita. Or, you know, in this harvest season, they just go glean from the field. Because you can't always do that.
They store?
You can. You can means in these things, but you can always find something. You can go to the markets, you can go to, you know, people in their houses are threshing or doing things and the stuff is left. You know, so like this you can deal. So, then on that, then somebody could keep a store for 1 year. Somebody could keep a store for, I think, 6 months, then there's 3 months, then there's 3 days, then there's 1 day. So each, you know, later one is considered better than the one before. So that Brahmin who only keeps enough for today is considered the best. Because then that means they're fully dependent on the Lord. They know if they deserve it, they'll get it. If not, you know, how it'll come, they don't know. That's up to the Lord. You know, they make their endeavor, but that's it. So they only keep enough for 1 day. So if they get more than enough for 1 day, they give it away. You know, because there's other Brahmins in need. So they give in charity also. So it's also said that depending on how much you have, you're using that many occupations. So to get a store for 1 year, you may have to use all 6 of them. You know, and as it goes down, then you're using less and less. But definitely for the 1 day or 3 day, 1 day that then you're using these higher ones.
You need a very qualified wife on that also.
Yeah, of course. That's why they must marry equal. It means such a qualified boy who would live by that should marry a girl who can accommodate that. Yeah. That's the whole thing. It's just like, what's his name? Jarlath Karu. He was a brahmachari, but his purpose was to go to the heavenly planets, but he didn't marry because it was too much trouble, so he just did his austerities. And they were Yajavas. I can't remember. There are a particular group of Brahmins who don't keep a house. So they walk during the day, and when the twilight comes, sun goes down, wherever they are, that's their house. You know, and they can stay there, you know, I think probably after a few days, if they want. But that's how they live. Wherever they end up in the evening, that's their house. So then he bumped into some, you know, looks like kind of like sages hanging upside down on a thread, you know, when a rat was eating the rope, you know. So it's just one thread left. He was saying, you know, who are you? What's going on? And they said, oh, yes, you know, because no one to do our Shraddha rites, you know, because our descendant is a brahmachari and he's not, you know, performing the rites because he wants to go to the heavenly planets, but he's not himself, is not caring for us. So, you know, he asked, what can I give him? Message? Who is that, like that? And they explain it and then he figures out it's him. So then he says, okay, I'll get married, but only, you know, on a few conditions. One is that the girl that I marry will have the same name as me. Because Jarakaro means big waist. Like that. Means that he was very big, powerful person, but by his austerities he's wasted his body away. So he says a girl that has the same name, he would marry. Because then there'll be same mentality, equal nature. So that was one of the conditions for his marriage was that. Plus, since they were only going to have that child, like that, then she has to be, means whoever gives her to him, she has to be actually maintained by them. Because he'll just give the child and then he'll leave because he's performed his duties. But the principle was is that she must be equal. So that's the thing, is that then they would match. I mean, there's always individual, but that is why then the wife is submissive to the husband. She makes that final adjustment, you know. They put basically Brahmins together from the same kind of like community, and they'll have basically the same values. But the fine adjustment then is done by the wife. That's why it's not good to have completely different natures, because then the wife has to give up her nature, you know. You know, if it's lower and she comes to the higher, that's nice, but lower may not always come to the higher. And if the wife is higher, then that's always a problem because she shouldn't come down. You know, but at the same time, it's very hard to be submissive to the husband if you're in a higher position. So therefore, it's always mentioned equal nature is important. You know, then they can relate to each other. Yeah, everything's common for them. Does that make sense? Yeah. Anything else?
To sacrifice the Bali Dan.
Yeah, Bali Dan means is the offering to the all the various living entities. Because all kinds of living entities are there that you get benefit from for living in your house. You know? Mm-hmm. All the different things your house is made out of. You know, here it's made of wood and, you know, glad this and that. So you have so many living entities you owe a debt to. You know, there's various in the Vastu Mandala. He has all his associates, all that, so they're all to be respected.
So we're using it all in Krishna service.
Means we just engage in Krishna service. So then all debts to everybody is taken care of. But for us, then there's still the culture of taking care of guests and that. So those elements that are common for us as part of Vaishnava etiquette, those are maintained, and they have to have their source in the Vedas, so therefore you'll find that they are mentioned in the Dharma Shastra. Then the Pancharatra and others will, quoting from there, will then apply it. We know it comes originally from Vrindavan, and then it comes down to that platform. But you know, the process is because we get it from authority, and authority is the Veda. Therefore, even though the Veda is in this, it's the expansion of what's in Goloka. Right? Does that make sense? But that's what's the top here, because it's a reflection, so it's inverted. So it looks like the Bhagavat Pancharatra come after the Vedic. So then, to maintain the principle of progression, then they always are based on, in quote, Veda. Even though technically they're higher Shastras. You know, they're the source of that. So being the source, you can naturally quote. Right? Because Veda is simply quoting Bhagavat. Right? So that means that here in the material world, Bhagavat can quote Vedic. Does that make sense? Because it's just the same thing in inverse order. You know, it's just like the father teaches the son. You know? But at the same time as then, the son speaks and the father could quote it. You know what I'm saying? Because he'll say the same thing. That, so those who know then appreciate it in that form. But that's the culture, is that working under authority. So therefore it needs to be maintained. Does that make some sense?
It seems like Vartmanishtita comes from Nishka.
Can be, yeah, could be, easily. Because it just means stable. You just maintain that position. You don't change. Well, upakurvana means then they give up that position. They become grihastha brahmacharis, but they're grihasthas.
I heard also like Swami Sivananda, in his famous book about brahmacharya, he quotes also additional level like akanda brahmacharya, one who keeps celibacy for 12 years, although he would before he could not be naishtik. I mean, like for us, like we are coming from western part of the world, place which does not have anything, you know, close to Vedic.
I mean, one who takes up the practice, yeah, and then having done it for 12 years is called a kanda. Yeah, but it would be, but what is their purpose? Is their purpose to be naishtika or to be upakurvana?
No, to be naishtika.
Yeah, so that's just a sub-branch of naishtika. It's not, it doesn't stand on its own. Mm-hmm. Naishtika means he's dedicated himself to following the Vedic principles. Now you've come to brahmacharya at 5 years old or 8 years old. So you weren't before. So if you come at 20 years old, it's the same principle. It means once starting it, then one doesn't give it up for the rest of their life. So that's naishtika. Mm-hmm. You know, you could differentiate, and when you say naishtika, that means whole life has been. And, you know, whatever it is, this akanda means that they've taken it up. You know, it's like the difference between nivasi and vasi. Damvasi, damnivasi. Damvasi means they're born here, they live here. Nivasi means they've come from somewhere else and made it their residence. So technically, it's not their place. Like that. Aindra mentioned that. He says there's those who are born in the Dham, there's those who live in the Dham, and then there's those who die in the Dham. He says those who die there, they're the most fortunate.
All right. In Jaiva Dharma Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he's mentioning that anyone who is an outcast but takes up to a Vaishnavism, he's gaining a position of a Brahmana in the paramarthika sense, meaning a spiritual sense.
Yes.
But still in the social realm, he should act as a whatever
his position. Yeah, yeah.
Meaning that he shouldn't perform sacrifices on behalf of someone.
Yeah, that would be there if he's working outside. If he's working inside the community of devotees, then you have to see. But you have to see what his nature is. And it means within that, if he has a brahminical nature, though his background isn't that, then he can perform those duties. But if he doesn't have a brahminical nature, conditioned nature.
But it also relates to karma kanda. The sacrifice.
Yeah, that kind of thing, yeah. Because then but the point is you have to have brahminical nature to do those. So you take an occupation that fits your conditioned nature.
Mm-hmm.
Like that. So it wouldn't be done. But its most main importance would be probably for marriage. Is that someone from that kind of background would naturally be what you would marry, because then the relationship would be common. Mm-hmm. Like that. That's the point. Is not now that you are, you know, have attained the status of a Brahmin by, you know, on the transcendental platform, doesn't mean now that you know, outcast person
can get married to
a Brahmin girl, because then the thing is she'll have a whole one value system, he'll have a completely different one, because in marriage,
then it's basically what is your conditioned nature, that's how it's going to function. So one, therefore, he recommends you should always marry in your own community. So that, you know, for us basically means community of devotees, but you should see that that nature is similar within that, the value system and the methods and all this. You know, it's simple, it's sophisticated, it's, you know, urban, it's rural, it's, you know, it's more economic, more devotional, less devotional, like this. You should see that there's a match, otherwise there's always going to be friction.
Maharaj, you, I remember in one of your seminars you mentioned that men are actually much more emotional. They could be much more emotional. They
it's not
could be much more profound and deep.
Yeah, profound in the emotion. Not that they'll be... Because generally we say emotional, it generally means the manifestation of emotion. So that will always say women are emotional because they manifest it. But the depth of the emotion, generally you find if a man focuses in there, he'll go deeper.
So that means men also can understand much more deeper, spiritual, you know, all these higher levels.
On the conditioned platform you could say yes, but on the spiritual platform it doesn't matter. Like that, because spiritual realization is not restricted to male or female. Though that may have an effect on it. You might find the man may be more focused, the woman not. She may be get distracted more by, you know, feminine needs and all those. But you can get a woman because of her religious nature is more Krishna conscious than the man who hasn't focused himself. You see that also. You know. That would be this. So you have to take each individual case separately.
Sometimes in devotion they say that the ladies they blindly will take and they
yeah.
they take it into their heart, whereas men will be calculating. And
yeah, yeah. The man will analyze it first, and if he accepts it, then he's fixed in it. Because he's gone through the stages and he's fixed. The woman might take it into her heart and blindly follow it, and as long as nothing goes wrong to change that method, then they're fixed and it's great. So that's why they need the men to keep them like that. Because if something goes wrong and they have a bad experience, that's it. They reject the whole thing just as easily. So that's the danger of that method. But at the same time, is that method under the protection and guidance of a, you know, man who's gone through those steps and has accepted that, then she'll stay on track and then it's no problem. That's why it's the main principle is that she's religious. You know, and fixed in in performing the proper activities of Krishna consciousness. Whether she has great spiritual realization or not, because she's attached to the spiritual process, then she'll attain, she'll perfect herself. Well, the man should be self-sense-controlled and understand what's going on. You know, because otherwise it won't work. Because a man is just sentimental and he's no brains there, he'll be even worse off than the woman. Because a woman, at least when she's emotional, there's some brain working. You know, so if the man's purely emotional, then kind of they lose her at that. You know, that's why the areas of emotion that the man gets involved in, according to Vedic culture, is all set by the rules. So it's virtuous and this and that, then they can confidently go on being emotional. They don't have to worry that what they're doing is stupid because it's already been worked out that it's already perfect. So that's the advantage of the data.
It's also noteworthy that in the Vedic culture, the men, they were not afraid of showing, you know, like Arjuna, he cried when Abhimanyu died. I mean, they would cry so much, the men, also.
But it's not a sign of weakness.
No.
It's a sign of relationship and duty and these kind of things. You know, it's like, he's crying, he is a father, couldn't protect his son.
Right.
You know, like that. And that kind of a mood. You know, that here's the person dependent upon him and he can't take care. So then he'll feel bad like that. So you do even have your higher realms of that rather than it's just the loss of the relationships. Like the mother may be, that may be her lamentation.
Yeah.
Father would be, you know, of course the relationship is lost, but there's that sense of the duty.
There is a duty involved.
Yeah, but he couldn't protect.
They ought to do something about it. They ought to do something about it, like his John said.
Yeah.
Go down and slaughter.
Yeah.
If he takes a vow to slaughter, you know.
Well, he'll kill Jared Ratner.
And he, you know, massacres 12 miles of soldiers who are in between.
Yeah. Man's got to do what a man's got to do. Yeah. The fun thing is that in between they stopped their horses and shot a water weapon and created a whole oasis and nice breezes, and the horses took and drink water and cooled down and everything and all that. When they were ready, then yoke them up and then again go. So it's the little interlude that's there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.